but the list as it is, it's fine, Chair, except that we must also add that name of Kashida.
Thank you very much. I think Honourable Tierko is just referring to an earlier decision we also took, which is minuted, and the decision we took in principle that we would identify people who had made submissions, etc., but experts, not necessarily people who agreed with us. In fact, it's very constructive to identify those who don't agree with one. And I think here, a very good choice there, Professor Kajika, who holds the Anton Mostet Chair of Intellectual Property, I think it's at the University of Stellenbosch. Yes. Now, that is a proposal we have from the chairperson of the subcommittee. Yes, Honourable Tierko?
Chair, it looks like members, I don't have the list of...
The bus was late for you yesterday, but it was distributed. Does everyone have this? Well, let's just issue it again. No, I know, but often names escape one. I know, for example, we'd already mentioned, I think, on a previous occasion, I think we were in Mark's building, the advocate Natasha Patha and advocate Zodwa Gumede. Remember, that was already agreed to. So I'm opening it up to the rest of you who thought that you needed a bit of time. That was 2 weeks ago. I've been, 10 days ago was last Friday, so it must be at least 14 days now. But so that you feel you're more at home with it, the list is not cast in concrete. It isn't closed, follow? But that it can be added to if necessary. So let us leave it there. Is that not our decision, Chairperson?
Thanks, Chair. That is the decision, and we also said the other political parties must submit their preferred names. So ourselves, we said the Kashiga advocate, the two advocates, Advocate Natasha and Advocate Gomez. So we can listen to other members, other.
Look, put it this way, other parties may well agree, and as I've just said, they'll add to it. Are we agreed on that basis, members?
Yes.
Right. Let's move on then. There's no great disagreement. And go along to the second part of this. Thank you very much. And we're going to ask you, Mr. Hermans, is it Mr. Hermans or Mr. Medema, for the copyright? Mr. Medema, while you're walking around, we would want a letter to be drafted for me to sign to the various people, their terms of reference, etc. Where are you? Thank you. Right. No, for a moment, I thought you were preparing a short novel. Right, okay. But let it be. Mr. Medema, have that on my desk if possible this afternoon. All right. Thank you. But as I said, you may add to it later. Last point, anyone, before we move? Right. Well, here it is at 10 to 9 or so. We're going to go back to the deliberations on the committee bill dealing with debt relief. Debt relief. So we're in your hands again, once again, Advocate van der Merwe. You know, I'm sure this is bedtime reading for you. All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Chief. I want to get closer to the microphone. I would suggest that we perhaps go back then to where we started, or this yesterday we went through a number of the questions that were outstanding, and a lot of them have been answered. I've quickly just taken the report of the subcommittee that we used yesterday and done this document that's up there so that we can just see what is still outstanding. The first thing that is outstanding is the issue of the value of 2,000 Rand, and it appears that members were rightly concerned about the 2,000 Rand limit when we look at realizable assets. The Department of Justice proposed that we look at the Magistrates Court Act in this regard, and the prescribed limit in the Magistrates Court Act is 2,000 Rand for these assets. We then asked Justice, where did they get this amount from? Well, how did they arrive at this amount? And in fact, Margot detected that it was already the amount that was in place in 1994. So we asked Justice whether this amount has ever been reviewed in between, and you know that there was an active decision to keep it at 2,000 Rand, if that's possible. But it turns out, according to the Department of Justice, that this amount has not been reviewed since 1994. Yes. So it is actually quite scary, because that also means that for your normal civil judgments, you know, it's almost a value. I did an online inflation check. I'm not saying that it is the perfect inflation check, but the value of 2,000 Rand today, what it was in 1994 today, is about 400 Rand. So, so that is quite scary. I've looked at a calculation online. I think Margot also checked something online, and I think we came to very much the same amount. So 2,000 would, in today's cost or value, be around 8,173. Now, I don't know if we should up the amount to 8,173, but perhaps we can rather look at an amount in that area. So perhaps make it 8,000, maybe on the one side, or maybe 9,000 or 10,000 on the other. So a nice round amount is normally it looks good. And I think we can justify, because that is the inflation that since 1994. I would in fact propose that we perhaps up it to 10,000 Rand as a nice round amount.
Yes, I'm very pleased we raised this issue, because it was a matter of concern. Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
Thanks, Chair. I agree with that figure, and I think that we should make it 10,000 Rand for each of the categories, because that would, you know, cover any... and it's a realistic figure, Chairperson. I think we should be realistic, absolutely. Thank you.
I said yesterday I couldn't agree more. Yes, Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
I'm very satisfied, Chairperson. Thank you.
I'm trying to think. You didn't have more than two children with that limitation.
Yes? Can I just elaborate? It seems to me as if Honourable Williams is not understanding what I'm satisfied with. With the 10,000 Rand, I'm satisfied. Thank you very much.
One does need to spell it out, huh? But just while we're on the subject of you, Honourable Williams, thank you very much for chairing so effectively in my absence. Thank you. Right. Can we proceed then? We're all agreed then. Are we on that amount professionally? But not just professionally. The point you've made is in all the categories where it says 2,000, which today amounts to 400 Rand in value terms. Do you want to just come in there? Yes, thank you very much. You know, it just shows I've been away 1 minute and I've forgotten everyone's name. I've only got half your name here. Linguini, and I mean, it's just got low. This is incorrect. Incorrect here.
Don't worry, Chair. I also struggle with the pronunciation, so you are excused. My concern with the
I don't say I disagree or agreeing with the 10,000 rand chair, but I just want to see where is it, because last time I remember I had a query on the, I don't know, is it the 3.5 issue. So I would just like to see where is that going to gel in with that amount, or with that amount ever as well also, for instance, review. So I will reserve on the 10,000 rand now until we get to that one later, Chair, because I remember that was also part of the inputs last time. Sorry, I didn't attend yesterday's meeting, so I don't know if you have covered it already.
It may be constructive here, Advocate van der Merwe, you know, if you can just go back to that. Do you recall the page we're on with all those figures of the 2,000? It was professional, it was personal, etc.
Chair, that is page 13.
Of you dealing with this for the first time, it's CB, is it? CBDR 2017-57, page 12 and 13. Actually, that's not the right one. There's a new bill. Right, on this new bill here, it's page 13, the one that was handed out that you can see in blue on mine. Is yours blue?
Yes.
The top of page 12. Do you see the figures underlined and highlighted in blue?
Yeah.
Right. Is this in line with what you were thinking, or would you like to still reserve your comment there, Honourable Slinguini?
I think I will reserve it and see. I'm in terms of my figures, Chair, because the way the advocate have worked it out and have come towards the 10,000 rand and so forth, like, it's fine. It's a factual figure and stuff like that. It's not something that is just grabbed and cast up out of the air. So I would like to see the same maybe for that query that I had last time in the last meeting for the 7.5 in that aspect. The figures, I think it was 7.5. I would like to see more or less the same, calculation. Thank
all
you.
Right, so there's an agreement on this position here under the two, etc. However, in the light of that, I think there's a need for us just to review and flag the other point. So we'll flag that one. Is that okay? Fine. Let's move. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The next point that we need to look at is on page 21 of the bill. It is subsection 7, and we deal here with limiting the person who successfully applied for a credit intervention, a debt intervention, to limit that person's right to apply for other credit. So what I've done is I've made this little picture thingy. I call it a pictogram. I'm not sure that I'm 100% correct. These are the orders that the tribunal can make. So perhaps if we can just get our heads around that, and then I will take you further to those time periods. So, to the left of your document, on the screen you'll see it big now. These are the almost non-debt intervention, if I can call it that, orders that they can make. So they can reject, the tribunal can reject the application, can say, no, this person is a debt review candidate, we'll ask the NCR to send this person for debt review, or the issue of the reckless and the unlawful agreements. They can declare those agreements reckless and unlawful. So these are the almost non-debt intervention. Then if we go to the green box, the other order that they can make is to cap interest, fees, or other charges for a period not exceeding 12 months. this may be 0% at which they cut them, and they can determine the monthly installment. The next step in this order would be before the end of those 12 months, the consumer must come back, there will be a review, and at that stage, the tribunal can either extend for another 12 months, this capped interest and so on, or reject the application at that stage and say, no, you no longer qualify, we can see that you've sorted yourself out, or say, no, now you qualify for debt review, refer for debt review, or say, no, I can see we need debt intervention and grant debt intervention. Now, part of this, and that is where I want to just make it a little bit now smaller, if you go to the bottom right of that page, you'll see that there are some conditions. One of the conditions is the limitation on right to apply for credit. So, when the tribunal makes one of these orders in the green box, the tribunal can make an order to say, I'm going to cap interest for the next 12 months. But in case you don't come back to me for that review, or if we are already in this next extended period, the tribunal will say, I want to make an order that you are not allowed to apply for credit after this period of the order, and so for another 12 months, you may not apply for credit after this order's effectiveness. So this is how we work with the green box, and keep that condition in mind. The other box then is the big purple box. That is the... my screen is now messing with me. Sorry, my screen is just messing with me because it's a touch screen and then it seems that I'm touching it too. It likes what I'm doing and too much. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so this is the purple box then. This is the debt intervention order. So the committee has decided that we want a fixed progression of orders. So the first order would be suspending all qualifying agreements for 12 months. At this stage, and you will see that the little condition box next to it also points to this purple box. At this point, the tribunal can say, suspending for 12 months, you are not allowed to apply for any further credit for another period after this, in case the person doesn't come back. But then the person comes back, there's a review, the tribunal either extends that suspension and can again make that condition. If you don't come back after 12 months, it will be, you may not apply for a certain period. Or the person comes back and the tribunal now says, okay, I see that you've fixed yourself up, I'm going to release you from this measure. And at this point in time, I'm going to release you, but for a period of 24 months, you may not apply for credit. This is your rehabilitation period. So make sure that you stay on your feet, that you become responsible in credit. Or the tribunal can say, I see that there's a problem. We are going to extinguish your debt. We're going to give you a clean start. But with this clean start, I'm going to give this condition that for a period of, let's say, 36 months, you may not apply for either credit. So this is the order, if we look at the order sort of set out. So that is just a summary of that. If we then go to these time periods, just make it a little bit. So what would be the effect of this condition? And that is what this committee needs to decide. The first question is, should we give the tribunal a discretion to make this condition, or should it always be a mandatory order that is made with every single order that the tribunal is making? In other words, if I give you cap, I must say that it's suspended for 12 months. Or even we can even make it automatic. If you receive the cap, it is automatically, your right is suspended for 12 months. If I've suspended the credit, your right to apply for credit is suspended for 24 months. Is it something that must automatically apply always, or do we want to give the tribunal a discretion to put that order in place or not? The reason for a discretion would be that the circumstances of the consumer before the tribunal might be such, it might be a person, for instance, who was retrenched and has, in fact, up to the date of retrenchment, been a model citizen when it comes to credit. In fact, the credit records and everything will show that it's up until the date of retrenchment that this person was modeled, and after that you can see the problem kicked in. Then the person gets a new job, maybe even have rehabilitated themselves, and now they want to apply, they want to again have credit. So the question then is, if the tribunal sees this person in front of them and says, okay, but I see that you are now applying for other jobs, you might even get another position, I'm going to do this 12-month suspension for you, but come back after 12 months, let's see how it works, and then I might release you. Person comes back, has now a job, the tribunal says, I'm going to release you from this. But then if the 12 or 24 months automatically apply, it means that that person won't be able to apply for credit in the next 24 months. It's not to say that that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that might be a reason why you wouldn't want it to apply automatically. So automatic would be the easiest way. It would be the surest way because everyone will know this is the situation and it is limited. That's it. So let's look. So that's the first question. If it must be automatic or if there must be a discretion in giving that order. The second question is how long? Should it be the same for every order? Should there be different periods? So these are the periods that I'm suggesting, and it's really just a thumbsuck from my side just to put something on the table for discussion so that we can get some idea in our heads. So what I've done is I've made it a progressive increase in the period depending on the seriousness of the order. So if you were making some repayments, even against the capped interest, then I'm saying a maximum of 12 months after the expiry of your capped repayments. If we look at how that works out, your first capped repayment is 12 months, then that could be extended with 12 months. So it could be between 12 and 24 months that you will be receiving this, be subject to this order for capped repayments. If you are then given a 12-month limit on your right to apply for credit, it means that this person in total will be taken out of the credit system for between 24 and 36 months. So that's the first. So the 24 months, the 12 or the 24 months is because of the order that applies, and then the further 12 months would be the rehabilitation period. Where there was suspension, in other words, the first order of the debt intervention was given, your debt was suspended for 12 months. That can be extended again for 12 months. So we're looking at 12 or 24 months under which you were part of, during which you were receiving the debt intervention. Then the period that I'm suggesting after that is a maximum of 24 months. So I've just made it, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. That was just what I did. The period then, the full period, if the person was in fact released after the first or the second suspension period, would be between 36 and 48 months that this person is removed from the credit market. If there was a suspension and in the end it was extinguished, then we're looking at your maximum could be, if it was suspended twice, for instance, it would be 24 months. Your extinguishing would be on the end of that 24 months because it's immediate. Then I said a maximum of 36 months, and I was 3 years. That would mean that this person will be out of the credit market for at least 48 months, but not more than 60 months, which is between 4 and 5 years. So part of my calculation was we received some inputs, and I think it was Mr. McPherson indicated 5 years. National Treasury also gave us some ideas. 5 years seemed to be with your debt review, your time that a period that a person is taken out of the credit market. So I've taken the five as being the most severe case and then have brought it down with a sliding scale. It could be 5 years for everyone. That is for this committee to decide. So that is just the thing that I'm proposing. So the two questions are, should it be automatic? Or And should there be a sliding scale in periods? Are we happy with these periods if there's a sliding scale?
Let's try. Let's look at that. Let's have all the parties coming in. Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable MacPherson, followed by the Honourable Flanguini.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm of the opinion that although the customer or the consumer that receives a debt relief package is a risk to credit providers, I don't think that we should extend their the period where they cannot apply for credit after the debt relief for a period of 5 years. I think we should try to reduce that quite substantially. I think that the maximum should be 2 years, and that we shouldn't, and that should be the harshest penalty that you can get excluded for. And I don't think we should, because you see, my concern is that a consumer might get debt relief to the value of 10,000 rand or 5,000 rand, and then they're not allowed to apply for credit again for 5 years. I mean, that's a bit hectic. I would say that it should be dependent on also the amount of debt relief that they receive. So there should be some sort of scale there. But I don't think it should go over a maximum of 24 months in any case whatsoever. Our maximum should be 24 months. Thank you, Chair.
And you're also, I understand, agreeing that it should not be automatic in any area. Right. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chair. First of all, when it comes to discretionary or automatic, the problem with discretionary power is that it leads most often to to inconsistency. So someone who is, two cases of the same example may be treated differently because of the discretion to put in a exclusion for one against the other. And the only way to mitigate that is to have strong categories of where people fall in. So I partly agree with the Honourable Williams when he says, should a person who has, 5,000 rand debt relief be excluded for a period of 5 years? That may seem, seem crazy. But a person who has 5 credit agreements of 10,000 rand each, who has, not paid or made no attempt to and qualifies for debt relief, I think that there would probably be a good case to look at a more prolonged exclusion. But the problem is that you can't see exclusion in isolation to rehabilitation. And exclusion and rehabilitation have to go hand in hand with one another. And maybe it's because I haven't been here for the last week, but I mean, I think the one thing that the discussion that hasn't been as at the fore as it should have been is mandatory education on debt responsibility. So, I think that what we actually need to do is look at what are the categories of people most likely to come in, and look at sliding scales for amounts of debt relief sought. Someone who has, as an example, to use the Honourable Williams's stated case of 5,000 rand, maybe that educational exclusion process would take 12 months or 18 months. Maybe someone with 50,000 rand may be longer. So I think that's maybe a way that we should approach it, because what I'm dead set against is seeing inconsistencies for seeing someone who has 50,000 rand of debt qualifying for relief and then, able to enter the credit market the very next day and get in the same position 12 months later. That would be a terrible thing on our behalf to allow them to do that. So those would just be my thoughts for now until we can actually have a discussion around creating those categories.
Yes, there was just the one point you made about, and I want to make it clear to see if I understand you. You seem to also link mandatory empowerment or education to the process of rehabilitation. Am I correct?
Well, I think that when people are, there is a mandatory, or there is an exclusion from being able to apply for credit, that must go hand in hand with education and rehabilitation. So we can't just keep people out of the market and hope that they will, by some epiphany, work out how to manage debt. So I think that those two have to be very clearly linked.
You know why I'm raising it? I think yesterday, those of you who were here, you will recall this issue came up, and a point was made by one of the members on the committee that, it doesn't exist at the moment. Is there the finance for that? Now, at the end, it is up to us here, of course. But that point was raised. Can we insist on it being mandatory if we don't have the funds to provide it? Or are we going to take a position in the committee here to say, we want that up and running the moment this bill is passed? I think it's important that we think seriously about it. Or are we going to say, this empowerment, this education, this training should be progressively implemented, and we put some sort of effective date, giving the department, the National Credit Regulator, banks the opportunity. So I'm flagging that because it was raised yesterday. And yesterday the position was, well, we can't really make it mandatory. Of course, we haven't taken a decision on the bill yet. So keep that in mind, all right? Next point, anyone else want to raise an issue here? Honourable Flanguini?
Thanks, Chair. I want to agree partly with, and I hear your views of yesterday, Honourable Chair, on the mandatory training and so forth, because we must also look as to what are we trying to achieve here with this bill. And one of its key pillars is to sort of help people out of debt. And I'm just thinking, when I looked at this time frames and so forth, because some of these people will, if, for instance, if they are not properly trained to manage their finances, eventually they will go and make debt. They will go to Mashonisa and all of that. And as a result, they will continuously stay indebted and so forth. So I think as well with the time frames on or the years, with the 5 years, I also wouldn't want to agree with it. I think we must make the periods a little bit shorter, because you also don't want a thing that is going to drag up. If a person, say for instance, is getting a promotion and the person can pay a little bit more for its debt, and say for instance, you understand my point, what is going to happen then? And then the person, you will still keep the person in that, locked in that process, and then a person can afford to pay, or for instance, to pay their debt. So I think we need to really look also, advocate, at this time frame and the mandatory training are fully chair. We need to make it a committee decision that we need to teach our people how to manage their finances. And that is partly why we are sitting and struggling as people, or South Africans, for instance, as you have even said it yesterday. You get individuals, when they get their first check, they go and buy a Mercedes just to, you understand my point, to flesh that I have made it in life. So that is part of what we are struggling with, is how we don't know how to manage our finances. Thanks.
It's a very serious point. Honourable Montage.
Thank you, Chair.
I wouldn't agree with the 5-year period because our objective is not to bar people from economic activities, but to assist them with the debt. And the education part of it is very important so that they don't go back to it. But it must depend, it must be determined by the rehabilitation process and whether the consumer is able to pay. But 5 years would be too much. We can't cut them off from the economy. Thank you.
It would seem then that, broadly speaking, the committee is saying, look, 5 years, no, that's too long. There has to be some period. And we need, as a committee, to fine-tune that. Now, are we looking at 2 years, and that's it, or are we doing what another option here was to say, well, it could be 2 years, it could be three. It does depend on each case. And already we've made the proviso in here that this will be a case-by-case approach. It's not a question of one size or response fits all. So, Honourable Macpherson?
Thanks, Chair. And if the committee would allow me, I really think that there needs to be a categorisation of applicants. So I think, to avoid the scenario that the Honourable Williams had quoted of, someone who's 5,000 rand, would be excluded for 5 years. So I think that there needs to be categories based on the amount being applied for, the number of credit agreements in existence, how long those credit agreements have been in existence, previous behaviour towards those credit agreements, and then that would allow us to categorise that person who would be. And I'm going to use the example that we use with the NRCS in terms of risk base. Someone who is sort of one application and 5,000 rand, may be seen as, someone who should only be excluded for 12 months. But someone who has been an habitual offender, who, is on and off, lots of credit agreements, maybe they need more help than the person with the one. So, they should be out of the system for, 24 months or 36 months until that time, they've been able to stabilize their finances and they've been able to go through the sufficient, education. So maybe if we create, two or three categories that applicants would find themselves in, it would then help the NCT to make these judgments based on the categorisation and the exclusion period for each category, and we can get away from sort of the discretionary part, which I think could be detrimental to the long-term objectives of the bill.
I think perhaps we need a little bit more comment here. I do hear what you're saying, but it would appear, certainly just listening to it the first time, as if we're going to truly complicate this issue. You're talking about various categories, almost research on the person, what's your background been and behavioural record in this respect. And while leaving it on the table for the moment, because I think other members should consider it as well, we should really unpack it a little bit more. What do we mean by the categories? Is this going to be on the basis of money, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10, or is it going to be, because you also referred to called a chronic case of getting into debt, as it were, every 5 minutes, people who can never get out of debt. Is it going to be on that basis, regardless of the amount? Or what is it going to be? Because one must weigh that up against the position that was taken 2 or 3 weeks ago when one said the discretion of the tribunal. The tribunal would have this discretion, as it were. So I want us to keep that in mind, because we've taken that position already, and what you're now saying. So just a little quick clarification, Honourable Macpherson, before we move on.
I mean, I don't think it's going to require a lot of sort of investigative, you know, work, because, you know, when the you know, when the papers come before the tribunal, the credit provider is going to be able to provide those credit agreements and the history related to those credit agreements. So, you know, no one's asking for people's backgrounds to be investigated. Surely that is what would be put on the table by the credit provider. So I don't think that that's too much of a difficult thing. What I mean, I think what my end objective is, Chair, is I don't want a situation, to use Honourable Williams's example again, where someone who has 5,000 Rand of debt, one credit agreement, is excluded for a period of 5 years. Equally, I wouldn't want someone who has 8 credit agreements, who, you know, has a, you know, bad track record of managing that debt, to be able to go back in, you know, in 5 minutes to, you know, go and do that all again. And that's the problem with discretionary, you know, power when it comes to this. And that's why I think that unless there is a categorization of an applicant and sort of a minimum and maximum exclusion period, coupled with mandatory educational rehabilitation, we're going to lose what we want out of this process.
Right. Let's leave it there for the moment in terms of the committee. And I know someone on the right here had a hand up, I was told. Who was it? Oh, the tribunal, the professor, and then yourself, DTI. Thank you. DDG.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. It was to contribute to this point of the how does one exercise the discretion. There is this practice that you lawmakers do of attaching codes of good practice to acts, and I think in this case it would be to the bill. And it would categorize, it would list those categories to provide just what must the tribunal consider when exercising that discretion. So it doesn't hinder the tribunal or the adjudicator, it enables them to be consistent in what they consider and how they consider it, without necessarily making it part of the section, but as a schedule attached to be read with that particular section, and then they flow together and you cover them.
No, thank you very much, Professor. Very solid point, and I'm sure that's also been taken up by the NCR and department. DDG Nyetsi Tenzi.
No, thanks. Mine is regarding this 2 years or 5 years. To say, it seems as if in practice, if a person is, say, a delinquent director, that person needs to be rehabilitated after the expiry, say, of 5 years. If my argument is true, however, that person can demonstrate in public that I've been a secretary of a civic organization and then a treasurer general, not eating money, so can approach the court earlier to prove earlier than that period, earlier, and said, yeah, please, look at me now, I knew. So therefore, I'm addressing the timelines to say whether it's done by this simple court, the tribunal, to say there must be some conditions that limits the time because of being baptized anew, if I may use that expression. So because this, we may exclude a lot of people in the marketplace. We are dealing with the economy that needs to be driven by the consumer. Therefore, if we exclude a lot of people because of the stringent thing, time period, there can be a problem. So I'm just saying, akin to the normal practice where you can approach the court and reduce the time earlier, it may be done in the tribunal. I don't know how the crafting can be done, but I'm persuading the Honourable House to consider such approach. Thanks.
Essentially then, DDG, you're proposing that members consider some form of appeal process in terms of, can't I make it sooner instead of 3 years, can't it be 2 years? So that's what, am I right, isn't that what DTI is putting on the table as well? Before I come to Treasury for a comment as well, may I come to yourself, Honourable Buyani?
Thank you very much, Chair. I don't know, my proposal was to say, can't we have, can the period should be determined maybe by the credit status and also the rehabilitation of the consumer. Then secondly, if the consumer pays his or her debt in full, then we can start made with regard to say, no, now we are done with the consumer, that we can start the process of rehabilitation. That will be my submission.
Yes, I see we're coming back on at least two or three occasions to this idea that rehabilitation, some form of empowerment or training, it should be seen as part and parcel of that process. So once again, is already flagged that aspect. You're also bringing in the idea of, yes, we can study the credit history here, and that would perhaps inform the position taken by the tribunal. Of course, there's the old story of case history over a period of time. Case history is established, continuity, etc. But having said that, let's hear from, is it Ms. Gilbert? Is that right? Gibson, you know, problem of being away for a few days. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think this is it's a complicated issue. And worthy of the discussion that's taking place. I think if we think about what we're trying to achieve here, it really is about rehabilitation, and so we have to be thinking around how best to be achieving sustained rehabilitation. With that in mind, in principle, we support both having a period, whichever period that is specified as, of not being able to access more credit, because a lot of this is also becomes a behavioural response on the one hand. I think we also support, as we've previously communicated, the idea of education. And again, it shouldn't, in our view, be a once-off thing. The work that we've been doing with financial education shows that this has to be a persistent intervention for it really to help. And this is not just about credit. It actually goes beyond the credit per se and talks about your financial well-being and savings, and if you are going to be using certain products, what these products should look like and what you as the consumer should be looking at and making an assessment of what's right for you and not. That obviously can't be done in just a single session. That takes time. In terms of the CAT, I mean, what's being proposed relating to the categories, I think this is something that needs to be thought through quite carefully. On the one hand, we are wanting to distinguish in theory between someone who's a systematic delinquent, if we can call it that, and someone who behaviorally has been inclined to get him or herself into repeated trouble versus someone who, you know, there might have been some other cause that has led to getting in this position, be it a retrenchment or other. What's tricky though is how this can be assessed and how to not clog down or clog up the process. So to the extent that we're wanting to look at making this distinction, I would suggest that you then would need to have clear parameters that would make that as easy as possible for whomever is making the decision involved.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gibson. You know, there is a serious issue here. I think South Africa has got, for one reason or another, not a very high savings record, as it were, positive one. I mean, some of the figures one looks at here are that while you've got 77% of South Africans have transactional accounts, 48% had some form of credit, and that was an increase up from 2011, 24% increase in just a few years. On the other hand, only 23% of South Africans have any form of savings account. Now, the reason I'm saying this and mentioning it is because it begs the question as to when do committee members consider someone to have been rehabilitated, keeping in mind that during the period or process of rehabilitation, no credit, you're not allowed to get credit, not allowed to. So when, how do you know when someone's been rehabilitated? They've been prevented from getting credit, they're sitting tight here, and then you say, right, you've been rehabilitated. Doesn't even matter if it's after 5 years. You get loose on the street. It becomes a whole lot of cherry picking. Do you follow? How do we know when someone is rehabilitated? Or are we making an assumption that it'll be after 1 year, 2 years, or five? Where does this come from? And I'm genuinely asking this question because we keep on talking about the rehabilitation, Honourable Williams, Honourable MacPherson.
Jefferson, I think if we look at rehabilitation, are we not talking about rehabilitation of the debt? So in other words, then you've paid off the debt and you've rehabilitated, the actual money is now being paid back. Now, the way in which you think, I mean, that person may never be rehabilitated if they're going to just continue borrowing money indiscriminately, but they won't be able to get a debt relief measure again, and then they'll be in trouble. So, I mean, it's not like they can ever get a debt relief measure again. So I think that that's a very important point. You can't keep borrowing and getting the debt relief measure. You can only do this once. And so I think that's very important to understand and remember. Also, I think we must be realistic when it comes to the education of the people who have applied for debt relief, because if we, in a practical sense, if 3 million people apply for debt relief and it costs a minimum, or, you know, if we manage to get some sort of program in place that costs 100 rand a head, that's 300 million rand that we're going to have to come up with from somewhere. And that's if it only costs 100 rand a head. And if only there's 3 million people, it could be 5 million people at 600 rand a head. And so we must be realistic that we don't spend massive amounts of money on this, although it's very, very important. We could use the education as an incentive to reduce the time that you spend outside of the credit area. So instead of being excluded for a period of, say, 3 years or 2 years, you could reduce that period if you go on a course about finance, something of that nature. But I think practically we must be realistic about how much money government has to spend in its coffers on this program. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. Honourable MacPherson.
So, I mean, this is a bit odd to me now. So we want the private sector to extinguish debt. And we don't want any, well, very little partnership from government in assisting and educating people because it's going to cost money. That doesn't make sense to me. It seems to me that we want to maintain the good focus of the bill, but we haven't come up with any rational steps to actually educate people not to get back into that same place that they find themselves in now. We have to accept, whether anyone likes it or not, that this is going to have a cost to the economy. I mean, that's a fact of life. But we don't want to mitigate that cost to the economy, or we don't want to prevent that cost from the economy in the future because of, you know, financial implications for government. So the only people who must consider financial implications are the private sector, and that seems odd to me. So, you know, unless debt relief goes hand in hand with debt education, what actually is it then? It's a giveaway. That's actually what it is. It's a financial giveaway. And the only way to stop it from being a financial giveaway is to correct the behavior that put people in that place in the first instance. So, you know, I really think we need to think long and hard about this education issue, because it will take away the credibility of what I think is shaping up to be a credible bill. But unless we do something to effect change, it starts to head towards the giveaway scenario, which is what I want us to avoid.
I didn't understand the Honourable Williams saying that exactly, but I do, I think we appreciate the points you've made and the re-emphasis on education in hand in hand. Honourable Yesterhazen?
Madam Chair, thank you. You know, apart from that it might cost the state millions of rand, also, there's a big burden on financial institutions that must carry, and they will start bolting before they even give loans to people, and that will affect the consumers as well. You know, the tribunal will assess people if their financial situation has improved in any way. So the emphasis will really be the education. We've got debt counselling. We've got so many things. And the problem is, like you rightly said, South Africans are the most over-indebted consumers in the world. And that should have been actually stopped then. You know, I don't know why we got that far.
Let's try and pull this together a bit. Honourable Ms. Gibson.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of points, additional points, please. I think on the point about what is rehabilitation, I agree it is about cleaning up or removing the existing debt and being, we can call it, debt-free. But in addition to which, I think it's what's important is to also make the point it's about staying not debt-free but out of over-indebtedness, and especially chronic over-indebtedness. So it's not just a current, it's not just a point in time, it's to continue like that going forward. The proposal was made around consumer education and perhaps linking this to your time period that you're out of the market, as it were. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think creating the right incentives is very helpful. In addition to which, one of the practices which is undertaken by and the retail credit, the retail market, like the clothing, the retailers in particular, because they're often looking at borrowers who do not have a credit history, they adopt an approach of, let's not lend you 10,000 rand up front. Let's start with a small amount and then see how you go. And if that works, then we can increase it and see how you go. And that way, supporting firstly building a credit history and a good credit history, and making sure that trying to control, as it were, that the consumer's not taking on too much too soon in a way that's destabilizing for that household. So we could be maybe thinking of that as well in terms of a staggered re-entry into the market, which could be built into the affordability criteria, for example. On the cost of education, one thing that could be looked at is connecting this to, and I totally take the point around financial institutions not wanting to be burdened, but at the same time, there are benefits currently for financial institutions who are educating consumers through the codes, the financial sector codes, and this could be something which is attached. So there are these education programs happening anyway, and particularly by the banks, and so this is something that could be connected into that, and it's dovetailing and therefore not creating something new, and would have a particular purpose in mind. Just an interesting notion about the stock, savings. We have this idea that South Africans don't save, and that many poorer South Africans can't save because they don't have the money. And yet we see a huge amount of money sitting in stock wells, for example. And so what this seems to indicate is it raises questions around, it's not necessarily that poorer South Africans are not saving. And in fact, there's many South Africans who are trying to do the right thing and are succeeding in doing the right thing. The disconnect is that this is happening informally. And that then suggests that there's a problem with the formal sector, not necessarily that there's a savings problem, although we do know that we save too little anyway. But this is, I'm just adding it in because it's slightly more complex.
I think you have a point about the stock sells. I read the other day about the billions that there is in that market. I think it could also be who you trust and who you don't trust. And some people feel a lot safer in the stock fell than possibly in the more formal institutions, which can tend to be intimidating sometimes. But you also referred to retailers. I think it's very important for retailers to behave more responsible. They certainly start off low, yes, just 1,000, 2,000, but when they've hit the 20,000 mark, the sky's the limit for that lot. You get endless, what do they call that, mail? Junk mail, begging you to overspend. And so it cuts both ways. But coming back to the rehabilitation and education, I think the rehabilitation's got a bit of a negative tone. One almost associates it with sort of prison-like complex. But perhaps if we spoke about empowering people to stay out of debt, I like that, and someone was using it here, one of the members. And how do we persuade, that was the other good point you made there, I think, Ms. Gibson, that this, in fact, it was yourself, Honourable Esther Hazen, who first raised it, financial institutions, retail areas, etc., could be persuaded that educating and empowering their clients to understand about budgeting and how credit works could be to their own direct advantage in the first place, and may even enable them to score from the government or public sector in other ways. So that's another angle that's come in, which I think is a very positive one about the private sector. And on the other point there, Honourable MacPherson, you made the point that you thought, you know, the private sector shouldn't have to foot the major part of the bill, as it were, and government almost getting off scot-free. I don't, you know, perhaps you didn't use the word scot-free, but I think you did indicate that you thought that the private sector seemed to be having to, you know, take responsibility for more than they should. But I think it is actually a two-way street. I think it is a partnership between the public and the private sector, with both of them taking responsibility for empowerment. National Credit Regulator, DTI, as well, but also the media, social media and the media in general, have not only the mandate and responsibility to provide enjoyment and leisure, but also to educate and to keep people informed and abreast of things. So I think that we're coming towards, and I did like and appreciate the point you made, Honourable Macpherson, that it would appear as if we are heading towards a rather robust piece of legislation, but that we ought to just be cautious as we move along. So let's get this straight from here. We've got about two or three flags. The one flag was requested by the Honourable Plangwini earlier on about let's review this amount, was it of 7.5, etc., on the basis of what you pointed out with the 2,000, and perhaps that now should be 10 or 9. The other issue that has been flagged is the question of the period in which you may not take credit or get credit, etc. Linked to that has been the whole issue of empowerment, education, and that process which has been called rehabilitation, but what I would really prefer to have called something else, but at the moment we're calling it rehab. So we're looking at these. We're not necessarily, am I right, members, we're not necessarily disagreeing strongly with each other. We're saying we still need to find the right mix. Isn't that what we're saying, Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, yes, I think that we're all agreed in principle. We just need to get the nitty-gritty down, you know, the actual figures and stuff, but we all agree in principle that there should definitely be training. I'm just thinking, how are we going to do that? Who's going to pay for that? And you're right, government should pay for it as well. So I don't think we don't, in fact, we don't disagree. We're just working out the intricacies. Yeah.
Right, well then, on that note, and it's an early note, we can move on. Are we ready? Did you not have something to say, DDG, earlier? I may have overlooked you. Is you sure? Because
yeah.
I saw just a little note there. Right, okay. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I did propose that we use the training as a incentive for people to reduce the amount of time that they stay outside of the credit somehow, you know, it's go to the training, because we can say you must go for training or capacity building, and people just might not rock up, but if we give them an incentive, if they go to training, they will reduce that period where they won't be able to access credit.
And do you think we can fit this in some way, Advocate van der Merwe?
Yes, Chair, listening to what members have been saying, I think what would be maybe the easiest is for me to draft two or three alternatives and put that up, and we can decide from there. The issue of going for training, I think what we'll just have to determine is if it is not training specifically offered by government, how will that be accredited? So who will we accept? But then it is quite easy. We have a just to remind members, you know, we're working on this bill for such a long time and we're kind of focusing on small areas in the bill. We do have provision, Member Lingwini is now gone because she was asking about changing circumstances. We do have provision, if your circumstances change, that you can approach the tribunal for a different order. So we have made provision for where circumstances change. In the rehabilitation clause that we have, it's a different type of rehabilitation that we're talking about than what was discussed now. That rehabilitation clause is the one that ties into sequestration processes. In other words, if you have paid all your debt, and we have yesterday agreed that there must also be an interest amount that is with it, but the minister will prescribe the rate. So in that section, we can add another subsection to say that if a consumer can show submit a certificate from an accredited institution. I don't know how we'll do it. Perhaps the minister can prescribe institutions that will be accredited or that is regarded as providing good financial training. Then that person can apply for the period to be reduced. So that is very possible. We can do that. But I think the best way is to perhaps draft a couple of things. I'll do it outside of the bill, so we have it on one page. and then the committee can decide. But I just want to, if I can take the liberty, I've asked Trade and Industry just about financial education and what they're working on, and they've given me a lot of information. So I'm wondering if you know, they should not maybe just speak to that quickly so that we have the background, because if there is something ongoing at the moment that we can tap into and maybe just enhance it or include something in the bill to enhance it. I'm sorry, reading quickly, I don't have enough information to convey to the committee, but I mean they are here.
Well, look, I see yourself, Ms. Machigari, with your hand there. And perhaps it's between you and DTI, the National Credit Regulator. Won't you share with us what is on the table or available at the moment?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. We can perhaps take from the model that we use for debt counsellors. Before debt counsellors are registered with the NCR, they have to undergo some form of training for a number of weeks. And the material has been developed by the NCR. So we developed the material. We have accredited a number of training institutions that are the ones that provide this training to debt counselors. So for anyone to operate as a debt counselor, they need to then produce a certificate, you know, from such training to the NCR before they can be registered. And obviously, they are the ones who pay, you know, for the training. So in this instance, I don't know whether we would be able to say to the consumers that they would need to pay for, you know, for the training themselves if they're interested in going back into the, you know, mainstream economy to access more credit. But I think we can take, you know, from that model.
Well, look, at least you have material which may have to be modified somewhat, you know, in some cases. After all, debt counsellors are more on a professional level, in inverted commas. But we do have other entities, and we'll be calling on you in a minute, DDG, but the entity, the National Lotteries, I mean, there's also possible access there for certain NGOs who may get involved in this, the provision of this kind of thing, you know, because we don't want to increase the costs to the person already in debt, you know, undergoing debt relief. So these are aspects, it certainly would be helpful if we could have a look at that course, just an outline of it, CEO. Do you want to continue before the DDG comes in?
Yes, please. We are also engaging with a bank sitter for funding towards, you know, consumer education, and perhaps to avoid getting, you know, government to pay fully, you know, for this, we could get the bank sitter perhaps to fund, you know, this sort of initiative. But as I say, you know, we are still engaging. No decisions have been taken yet. Thank you.
Thank you very much. DDG? Nancy Tenzi?
No, thanks. I think we were conferring because of the advocate who asked the question to say, what is it that you are doing?
You need to do a novel.
Yeah. So we said in our regulations, the regulations is with the DTI, we impose the conditions that debt counselors must pass these requirements. That is how the CEO behind me was sort of reciting that these regulations, it was because of our imposition. So can't we transpose it, migrate it to the rank and file, but without raising the costs, because the cost can be a problem. Where will money come from? So, but I think at a principal legislative bar, the committee can progressively go towards demanding, like housing, I mean, if resources allow, then we can move to that direction. So I just wanted to clarify that it is from the regulations.
That's very useful. And but as I say, we just want to ensure that it is at an accessible level for the target group. Ms. Gibson?
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, so in terms of what's available, there's a lot. Because in addition to the credit regulator, specifically on credit, the likes of the credit ombud also does education that's specifically consumer-driven. The banks do the same. Just to highlight, we do have a national consumer education forum which brings these stakeholders together, on which both the DTI and credit regulator are invited participants on that. So we already also have the structure by which we can engage in terms of how to take this forward.
You see, a lot of this is already here. So it's a matter of all of us being fully aware, total coordination this time on, yes, DDG, and is your colleague there, you know, Mr. Sipa Mandla, getting agitated? Carry on.
No, we will talk. No, I just wanted to caution that when we are before you, we come here for mandatory issues because this is a legislature, not because of goodness. Yes, not because of goodness. So there may be sporadic actions that are happening outside, but here we want to build it as a statutory obligation. I'm just cautioning that some of the education and awareness that are taking place may not be helping the cause. Yes, that, I don't know, my colleague maybe wants to say something.
No, DDG, you're quite right.
Thanks, Chair. No, I think he has said it all. Maybe to say that even some of the education and awareness, they are not for the targeted market probably that we would have loved to target, I mean, as a committee. So, and also to reiterate the fact that some of the things, they need to be legislated. If people feel that they are not obligated to do them, then really it will just be a talk show. It won't bring the sort of the required results that we want. Thanks.
No, thank you very much. There's also at one point, I remember when the national lotteries was first proposed, one of the proposals that was made at that time was, you know, people are going to be buying these tickets all the time and you're printing back and front, etc. What about using these tickets or whatever it is to give this kind of public information, as it were? And you're printing anyway. Many, many people are buying it from all ranks in, you know, economic groups. And those are things that we should explore, a kind of social media type of communication plus, if you like, the more mandatory empowerment. But I must emphasize, it's one thing to become a debt counsellor, quite another to be indebted, and then to say to the indebted person, go and do the same course. It's not going to work. So we need to utilize that information, make it more accessible, and as they say in the ICT world, user-friendly. Did I see anyone else on my right before I go to the left? Because it certainly looks like we may have to have a sing-song or rap artist in here if people have fallen asleep. Right. Now, let's get back on track. You know, should we get back on track? So far, everyone's been contributing quite heavily without applying their minds to the social media this morning. So can you carry on then, Advocate Bantamurza?
Thank you, Chief. The next issue is also a bit of a hot potato. It is the issue of whether the minister should be allowed to prescribe debt, or whether, if the minister wants to bring a debt intervention measure into play, whether that should be done through legislation. In other words, he must bring a bill.
Let me just interrupt you for a moment. It sounds as if whenever you talk, there's a little drummer in the background who feels obliged to start drumming. But so if you could just raise your voice.
Thank you. I will do so. So the next issue to be considered is on page 28 of the bill. It is section 88S,
And the question is whether the minister should be empowered to actually prescribe a debt intervention measure. As we have it, the committee already, at the outset of this bill, if I can maybe just recap, because some members weren't here yesterday, when we started this committee bill, the first inputs that I received was a clause indicating empowering the minister to draft regulations in which there would be a debt relief measure. There were high-level criteria set out, and that is what we started this bill from. The committee at that stage expressed very, very serious concerns about giving the minister broad discretion to just prescribe a debt relief measure, for instance, if economic circumstances require it. That was just too broad for this committee. In fact, we had a long discussion in this committee, and from that discussion, Section 88F that's being inserted resulted. So it is very clearly set out to the minister what can be prescribed, the type of measure, the circumstances under which, and who may benefit. So that's the first thing that this piece of legislation will tell the minister in relation to a debt intervention measure. If the minister wants to go broader than that, the minister can, but then the minister must do so with the permission of the National Assembly, which of course will refer to this committee. What we also have done is to set out a more stringent consultation process. I explained yesterday that it is more stringent because it is set out in writing, but in practice, this is what normally should happen with regulations. There should be consultation before the matter, before the regulation is published for comments. There should be publication for comments. What Parliament is doing is, in the past, your legislation, I would almost say pre-2010, would simply say the minister may prescribe by regulation, and that would be it. But in the past 6-7 years, Parliament has started requiring ministers to bring regulations to Parliament for input, not for approval, because then we are sitting with a bill again. Just for inputs to come and consult Parliament before those regulations are in fact made. So that gives Parliament an opportunity to make inputs, to make comments, to debate it even in the House if necessary. So it is a normal thing to do. It's not that we are overextending. But what we do require is that the minister must consult, and this bill then will indicate to the minister specific areas, Minister for Finance, Minister for Justice, National Credit Regulator Tribunal, Credit Industry. Then we require the minister, and this is perhaps the extra step that is in there, to table a report in Parliament explaining what happened with these consultations so that Parliament can start applying its mind. Then during this process, that is where the consultation with the Assembly will take place. And then after this, so the first consultation is done, then the minister must publish for comment, take those comments into account, and then also report in the National Assembly on those comments as well. So our process requires one more report from the minister than normally would be the case, or is recently the trend to be the case, if I can rather put it like that. So the question yesterday came up, which would be the more expedient process? Because remember, one of the reasons allowing a minister to prescribe any measure, anything, is that there is a measure of speed involved in regulations. That is not necessarily the case with legislation. Legislation does take a bit longer. And that is still the case, even though there are reports required from the minister in our process. The prescribed process will still be faster. Parliament is required in any legislative process that Parliament does to also have public participation, to do due deliberations. Parliament also looks at that instrument in addition to other documents before the committee. So there's competing, with all due respect, a department has a number of divisions. This committee only has so many members. So there are those time limits that does affect a bill. So definitely this will be faster. if there is, especially if there's need for urgency, that it's faster to do it by way of regulation. The concern, however, on the other side was, if we are putting so many measures before the so many criteria, guidelines and things, we're making it so strict, shouldn't he just bring a bill? You know, is this not actually what we're requiring from him? So I think that is where the debate is. Is it really necessary to include for the minister to prescribe, or should we just say, at the time when it's necessary, bring a bill? There are measures in Parliament to also fast-track legislation, especially if the minister certifies it as urgent. The National Assembly rules do provide for that. So it can also be done fast.
Van der Merwe. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chair. So for me, and certainly for my party, it's difficult on this particular issue, and I'm going to explain why. As the advocate quite rightly pointed out, the minister only requires input from Parliament. That input from Parliament can be disregarded, and the minister, he or she, may proceed on that basis. I think that also such a clause also hinders the rights of lenders, because if just as an example in the debt relief process, you know, lenders are still able to, you know, provide information that may not quite stack up to what the applicant has made. It would also become very difficult to provide certainty to the credit market, because the minister may, specifically with point 88F. To see that it affect any groups of persons referred to in subsection 88F to C in such a way that no efficient or effective method to alleviate household debt is available to them. Now, for me, that's quite a broad clause, because how is the minister able to determine that on his or her own self? Will a study be done by the minister? Will information be provided to them? How will they be able to determine that an effective method to alleviate debt is not available to that group or geographic location? So for me, that's extremely vague. And for me, that is open to a minister to use that in any way that they may deem fit, which for me is not acceptable. So I think that what we wanted to do on the art was to provide once-off debt relief. That is something that was agreed to in the House. And I'm not sure from the beginning why these regulations have been added into a once-off debt relief bill. I think that if a minister wanted to bring a measure to a geographic location or resulting from job losses, and there may be very well need for that, I think that such a bill would have to come either from this committee again or from the minister. Because what we can't forget is that in relation to 88F2A, how do we know that those people who are suffering job losses don't in fact have credit life insurance? Why would they not claim against the credit life insurance and then receive debt relief? So I think that it's an extremely complicated and complex clause, which for me is does not have the required definition, can in fact be substituted by the minister bringing a separate bill or the committee doing so, and in fact works outside of the stated objectives of what was originally agreed to. So those are my thoughts and inputs, and I think also notwithstanding the inability of lenders to make representation to such an act or a decision, and certainly that it allows for ongoing uncertainty until when a next process may be undertaken again.
Thank you, Honourable Macpherson, Honourable Williams, Honourable Esterhazen.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the motivation behind giving the Minister these sort of powers is fundamentally when extraordinary circumstances occur. For instance, in March next year, when Cape Town, the city of Cape Town run out of water and a million people stand up and leave their jobs in Cape Town to go and find water, those people won't be able to service their debts. And this is an extraordinary circumstance. And therefore, if we wait for this bill to go through this committee and then through Parliament while these million people are heading towards the Eastern Cape and anywhere where the water is, it's going to take a long time. We're talking about natural disasters, massive retrenchments. These things have been put into the bill. We're trying to stipulate these things in the bill itself. So it's not like the minister can just decide tomorrow that, hey, there's an election, I'm going to, you know, give debt relief to an area that might not be in my political party's area, and I'm just going to help those people there. It has to be extraordinary circumstances where the minister can intervene. And to put it in this bill would speed up that process. So it's not like he's going to use it every year to buy support from the people. Like I said, it's extraordinary circumstances, massive retrenchments where people have got no chance of paying back those debts. There's going to be a massive problem there. If there's a natural disaster, for instance, you know, the fires could spread rapidly in the Western Cape. The city of Cape Town could be on fire tomorrow. You know, these are situations we're talking about, acts of God, and of course, acts of capitalism with regard to retrenchments. Thank you.
Well. Honourable Mantas.
Jobson, I stand in support of Honourable Williams. Currently, or this week or last week, there's been a huge retrenchment in mines. And these are the circumstances that we think would relieve people when this bill sees the dawn. And we would appeal to the opposition not to take us back, but help us to achieve what we're trying to do.
No, Honourable Esterhazen, I'm sorry, I forgot you. My apologies.
Thank you, Chair. Whatever the circumstances, when it comes to consumer credit, South Africa's got its back against the wall. And if the minister or the government plan to and debt forgiveness will have long-term impact. It'll only make it worth at the end for the consumers. The only way they can do it is to increase the interest rate. And I'm also very concerned, I think I mentioned it before, that the recalculation or the there's actually more refinancing of debt instead of rearranging debt and over longer periods, and this creates ballooning of the actual amount and over periods, and at the end it's only the consumer that pays, and it makes it more difficult for the financial institutions, and then at the end makes it more difficult for everyone, and that is.
Thank you very much, Honourable Esterhazen. You know, we've got two different positions here essentially on the table. One position, which, as I understand what you're saying, Honourable Macpherson, you are referring to an overreach possibly by a minister to take almost anything into account without any breaks on, oversight breaks, as it were, in your reference to simply an input, as it were. You also make it clear that the minister can always resort to a bill. Well, we know only two, unfortunately, in this committee, how long it takes to bring a bill, to process a bill, etc. Which is why I've no doubt we have the Disaster Act. Now, when something really goes wrong, you don't have the time to wring out processes, but you do need to put certain controls and brakes in. It's the same as one may do financially. No one wants to bail out a bank, and look at all the banks that were bailed out in Europe. So it's that kind of thing that one is looking at. And I understand Honourable Williams, frankly referring to something occurring, an exogenous shock, an act of God, someone would refer to it, that is beyond any country dealing with. It's beyond the regular thing. It doesn't matter how prudent you are, how resourceful you are, it overtakes you. So it's only in that event that we're saying we would agree to the minister doing this. But just one last thing before I recognize Ms. Gibson. The other reference was made to page 28, I think it's 2C. Was it 2C? Yeah, effectiveness, yes. Affect any of the group, etc., in such a way that no efficient or effective method to alleviate household debt is available to them. The question you raised, Honourable MacPherson, is how on earth is the minister going to have all this time? Is it only going to be left to him or her? And, a minister is there and is identified because there are certain things that a leadership has to do, a leader, whether that person is a speaker, a minister, a chair, or whatever. But let us hear from Ms. Gibson before we engage further.
Thank you. Yes, I think this is one of the components of the bill that we are concerned with. We recognise that, looking at two examples, is the retrenchment being a big one, so if we're talking about the mining sector or the likes, and other exogenous shocks like a disaster. Just putting that to one side, our understanding is that what we've been looking at here is there's a problem with how consumers are over-indebted today. And that has been the result of a lot of weaknesses and flaws in the credit sector. It's a credit sector issue. So it makes sense that we then need to deal where there's been problems with the credit sector. We should respond to it through the credit sector and the so-called debt relief. What we're talking about, retrenchments and disasters, this is looking forward now. This is not problems that have happened. This is problems which could happen. That is not a credit market issue. That's an insurance issue. This is a risk. There's a risk of retrenchment. There is a risk of disasters. And that is why you have insurance to deal with the risk of retrenchment and the risk of disasters. Now the problem with, or the challenge with disaster risk, if we can call it that, is it's a country thing. And often the private sector mechanisms don't work. So retrenchment, yes, possibly, but only for, if we talk about retrenchment, that then if we are wanting to ensure that people who are retrenched get their debt written off, we should be building that into, and basically a retrenchment policy into every single loan, which would mean that the risk premium is effectively being borne by everybody, both the insurer and the credit provider and the consumer. This is a funding issue. Otherwise, we're asking for credit providers to be funding risks which have actually got not to do with them.
Right.
So there are distortions that are created within that. On the disaster side, that's more complicated. So, for example, one of the areas that we've been looking at is agricultural insurance that relates to drought. Often the existing mechanisms aren't adequate, and it does need government intervention to create the mechanisms which can effectively deal with those kinds of recoveries, if we can call it that. But again, it's an insurance issue. It's not a credit issue. Also, just to highlight that the types of what's being proposed here, and my understanding is that the committee has been very much guided by the international evidence on this. And our understanding of what's being proposed here is that these ad hoc measures go beyond what has been considered in the international. And it goes beyond for two reasons. Firstly, in two different ways, depending on what the international case study is. Firstly, is that in most instances, it is dealt with expressly through the primary law, as has been contemplated in the earlier parts of today's session. Where there are more ad hoc, if we can call it that, or ongoing types of arrangements which are provided for, there generally is no private sector loss there. Those are actually where there have been government loans or government-related loans, which are then, because they're government-issued, government can then say, well, you know, we're going to be writing off. And my last issue in relation to, on the basis that these provisions do go ahead, we obviously then think that the Minister of Finance should have a stronger role to play in terms of, at the very least, banks and systemically important financial institutions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gibson. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Hazen afterwards.
For me, I think my focus is on the part around no efficient or effective method to alleviate household debt available to consumers. Now, for me, that is so wide that you know anyone could qualify for that. What is classified as efficient method to alleviate household debt? Is that around the timing, how long it takes, the cost of it? I'm not sure. And who qualifies for that? Is it someone who believes that they can't go through the system, who has tried to go through the system? But what it also fundamentally does, I think, it actually undermines the bill in the first instance, because someone may say, well, I don't want to go through the debt relief process, let me try and lobby the minister for this. And it also undermines the debt review process, because without actually understanding the fundamentals of a person, how do you know that they cannot go through an efficient or effective method to alleviate household debt? And I think that it also does not, as I said, provide that certainty to the credit market that I think that they need to price risk going forward. Because whether we like it or not, if something like this is affected, lenders are going to have to price for eternity now in everybody's credit agreement that this may happen 3 or 4 times a year. And I'm not sure that's fair to the general population. So I ask the question again, why and how did this end up here? Because it seems to go beyond the scope of what was originally requested for a once-off debt relief measure. So until I think we can get some clarity on those, it is a worrying part of the bill for us. And I think that Ms. Gibson makes some valid points around insuring against things like job losses. We know I think that she makes a relevant point around insuring against job losses. That those options are there to consumers. And in fact, we've had a discussion before, and I don't know where that discussion has gone, whether we make something like credit life insurance mandatory. I don't know whether that was resolved. It was a subcommittee discussion that we had, because if in fact it was made mandatory, well then there would be no reason for 2A to exist. With respect to natural disasters, I'm not sure, and what the rationale is for the private sector to carry the burden of natural disasters, and what in fact would constitute a national disaster. But I want to make this last point, and it was a point that was actually made by my colleague, Honourable Hugh Lewis, who comes here from time to time now, is that when you put a provision like this in the bill, specifically with point C, you create a huge incentive for communities across South Africa to start classifying themselves as being inefficiently or ineffectively being able to alleviate household debt. And he put it succinctly like this, that we thought that fees must fall was rolling mass action across the country. Wait until debt must fall becomes a point for action. And I think that that's something that we need to really consider, is that we don't want to create perceptions in communities that something like that can happen. And I think that point C could potentially be a rallying point for something like that.
Very much, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Esther Hayson.
Thank you, Chair. You know, I agree completely that it's a risk. It's a risk for both sides, from whichever way you look at it. And financial institutions actually do insist for consumers to take out insurance if there's something like natural disasters and things. If there's retrenchment and things, I think the main purpose of the bill is to create a more friendly credit market by government. And what we would more actually look here is more for reckless loan relief, and that is the main problem. Not so much the debt relief, which is banks already look at very favorably of indebted clients if they maybe lose their job, retrench or anything. And we must ask, does this need to be backed up by informant measures now? Thank you.
No one has listened to what members are saying. Some of the things that spring to mind here are some of the inverse sort of spin-offs here. If, on the other hand, you talk about the client or consumer taking out insurance, making that mandatory, I often think, well, do you tell a worker, look, my friend, man, comrade, take out a little bit of insurance, you know, against retrenchment, would that not have an inverse result with a company thinking, well, they've all got damn insurance, we don't have to worry, we can become irresponsible. But of course, I'm just trying to get people to really sort of churn around their brain cells. Yes, Mr. Sipa Mandla.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. I just want to highlight a couple of few things. I think the debate now is being pitched at a point where we seem to be focusing more on the well-off. I thought that the purpose of this bill was to deal with people who are vulnerable, the 7,500, who might even not afford to pay for credit life insurance. Even if they have, it won't be enough, or it won't suffice to settle the outstanding debt. We're talking about those are sort of living examples on the ground, you know. So I just wanted maybe for us to focus, to limit our scope to dealing with people who are vulnerable. By way of an example, a person who's in Hout Bay or whatever that has happened there, majority of those people had no credit life because they couldn't afford it. Even if they had, they would not actually be in a position to settle all whatever debt that they might have. The mining sector is retrenching over 30,000 employees a year, of which most of them, they fall below the 7,500 in terms of the salary cap. We seem to be pitching it above people who are well off, who can be able to be given these options in terms of insurance. My own bank went ahead without any legislative, any notice, and paid millions of rands in Nisna when there was a disaster. But when it comes to consumer, there seems to be this market crash sort of narrative, you know. When government wants to make, you know, initiatives in terms of helping consumers, we have to go through a very strict process in terms of helping consumers. But something happens to business. I mean, most of the people who had houses in Nisna Bank, they were business people. And banks came on board. I don't know how they managed to approve values of over 9 million, 10 million to actually bail out those people. So, but somehow, I don't want us to pitch it at a very high level. Let's concentrate on the target that we have actually identified in terms of the bill and concentrate basically on that. Otherwise, we are going to miss the boat. Thank you.
Yes, I think, look, we've got a couple of pointers here, and that, yes, what is, I think Honourable MacPherson, you said and asked the question, exactly why did we embark on this, try to flag a path down the line, and you focused strongly on once off per se. The other thing that has been brought, we've been reminded of, we've known about it, but we've been reminded of, who is the target group? Who is this target group we're looking at? The third thing, we've been reminded by Treasury, there is a need to be prudent, to be cautious. And also, what is the purpose, on the one hand, of insurance? What is the purpose of XYZ? What is the purpose of some of these instruments? But again, we are reminded of the fact that many, many members of this target group, if not the 100%, do not carry the kind of insurance which would deal with this. So I just want to remind members, on the one hand, yes, there is this issue with the minister's discretion, his capacity to regulate, as it were, to prescribe a debt intervention. There is that to really unpack, to apply our minds on. When should this be in operation? On the other hand, who is the target group? And the third, are we simply going to inadvertently create a challenge, a further challenge, which simply encourages people to get into more debt or whatever? So we're walking a thin line here. Where are we on this line? Honourable Williams has on several occasions pointed out this is not just about debt relief. This is also to try and encourage a culture of savings. Yet we've heard from Treasury itself here in this room this morning that actually it's an anomaly to think that South Africans don't save. They may save in a different form. You know, the stock fells and that kind of thing. So I think this is actually quite a challenging one, because different committee members, different parties here, are holding slightly different views. We all agree there should be debt relief. However, we're just hitting a bit of a hiccup here. And I'd like us all to think very seriously on this before we open up our mouths again and contribute. Exactly what should we be leaving here? All right? I'm not going to tell you. I want you to deeply consider that. Let's hear what you have to say, Ms. Gibson.
Yes, thank you for that, Chair. And I think that the main feature that we're going to be taking home today is to be thinking, we understand what the problem is that we're trying to fix. We would like to, I think we're going to reflect more on what is the best mechanism or the different channel in order to fix that. I mean, I think that an important point was made by the DTI in terms of recognizing that we are talking about the credit going forward, not the credit that's and by our credit going forward, you might already have a loan, but you can build in these costs at any point going forward. That if we recognize that this is in fact, so if we take retrenchment for example, if this is in fact an insurance issue, it would be very important to make sure that the retrenchment insurance doesn't just pay off a portion of the debt, it actually pays off all of the debt. And for unsecured loans, I think that generally is the practice anyway. We're not talking about mortgages where retrenchment packages only kick in for a certain amount of time. So that should be built in, and that would then clear the debt for everybody, not just, it's not a for the wealthy, it would be even for anyone who takes out debt, even if they're earning 3,000 Rand a month. And the costs of those insurance premiums are capped, they're very low. And if we think about the benefits that could be pursued, but again, that's just one option, and I think we need to think of the others. I mean, the point on the NISA, again, this goes to the point of, this is the benefit of having insurance. Because if you are having insurance, it wasn't that the banks just came in, it's that there's people who have been paying premiums systematically for a number of years and are then getting the benefits of those premiums. So the insurance market, for all its problems, if it's done in the right way and it's applied for the right purpose, it can work and does work. And I suppose what we're needing to test is the extent to which that could be applied usefully within the segment and for the target market that's been identified.
Right. What I think I'll propose, because perhaps some of us would like to just turn this over in our minds a little, is to come back to yourself, Advocate van der Merwe. Let's half flag this so that we can review it again, and we may have time after we've gone through and address the rest of the issues.
Thank you, Jean. If I can maybe just point out a few things that members should also keep in mind when considering this issue. The first, if we look at 2A, we must keep in mind that you need to read 2 and 3 together. So in other words, these things can only be for people who earn less than 7,500 Rand or are indigent, so on. If we look at 2A, the significant exogenous shock that caused widespread job losses, the next point that we'll be looking at is the credit life insurance. And the agreement in the committee yesterday was that it should be mandatory, but we need to look at whether it should be for all agreements up to a maximum of an agreement. For instance, even with the cap of 4 and 50 per every 1,000, it comes to over 200 Rand. It is per month on your 50,000 debt. And 225 Rand might sound like nothing, but it is something. That's 225 Rand you could have used to pay off your agreement or pay towards an agreement. So that is a lot of money to be adding to one of the things that we were thinking about yesterday was whether it should be for all agreements. Ms. McPherson's proposal was that it should be a 50% of a certain, you know, up to a certain level of a certain amount of credit. There may be a 75% for a higher amount, and so on. So we need to also keep in mind that even the mandatory credit life insurance will only be going forward. So credit agreements that are currently entered into will not be subject to that requirement. So we will still be sitting with credit agreements for quite a long time where there will not be credit life insurance simply because the Act can only be prospective. So that is just on point A, to keep in mind that the even if we put in mandatory credit life insurance, we still will have agreements like that. On C, thinking about the debate, thinking about what we are saying, the purpose of C, the affecting any of the groups referred to in subsection 3 in such a way that no efficient or effective method is available to them, the reason for C was to allow for the minister to prescribe a proper NINA process. In other words, something that can remain in place. But perhaps, especially with the discomfort that there is with this specific paragraph, this is perhaps one paragraph that can be taken out of the prescribed section, in other words, 2C, to say that if the minister wants to set in place a program like NINA, that should perhaps be legislation. It is not something that needs urgency, whereas the other two clearly require urgent steps, a significant exogenous shock, a regional natural disaster. Those aren't things that you can plan for. But C is perhaps something that the minister can already plan for. And then that, of course, would then affect the in fact, 3 will remain the same there. So just if that could be just kept in mind going forward. If we then go to the next flagged question, it is in fact then the credit life insurance. So I just want to go to the in the bill, show you where in the bill we are. We are on page 31. It starts on page 31. So how the bill currently reads is that it is mandatory to have credit life insurance. The question, however, came up. So the first thing would be that if a credit agreement exceeds 6 months and the principal debt does not exceed, and then we had in the subcommittee the discussion was 50,000, 100,000, then there is a must for credit life insurance to be entered into. Mr. McPherson's proposal was that there should be a sliding scale. So a 50% cover for agreements up to 5,000 Rand, a 75% cover for agreements up to 20,000 Rand, and then 100% for agreements over 50,000. But on that one, and the reason why the subcommittee was talking about the 100,000 is if you look at a house, for instance, of a million, your credit, well, the house will not be insured. Let's look at a car, perhaps, that costs 300,000. So there you will have a monthly installment. Sorry, my math is not 100% good. If I'm wrong, people can help me. It seems to be about a monthly installment of 1,350 Rand for credit life insurance. I don't know. I'm not a policymaker here, but I just want to highlight that. That is a large sum of money to be paying per month for credit life insurance. And that was the thinking in the subcommittee, that this is not something where we want to go that high for all agreements. We are looking at your poorer income group. That is who we want to protect. The chances of them entering into one agreement that is 200,000 is really very, very low. So let's rather look at the type of agreement that they would enter into, and we protect them with this measure. So that was the first proposal. Exceed 6 months and does not exceed 50,000, or the sliding scale from Mr. McPherson.
Thank you very much. Members, have you followed that? It's linked very much to what we've been discussing. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I'm of the opinion that we should say that the term of the credit agreement exceeds 6 months and the principal debt does not exceed 50,000, and we should go for and that should be the where we make it compulsory for or mandatory for credit life insurance and nothing else, not above that, because using the example of a 300,000 rand car, people that we're looking at aren't driving 300,000 rand cars on their 7,000 rand, 7,500 rand gross salary per month. So they're not the people. We keep moving outside of our bracket, and this is confusing everything because it makes it look like we're going to give debt relief to members of parliament. And so we're not. We're going to be giving debt relief to people who gross salaries of 7,500 rand. So it's a very little. It's, you know, it's really the lowest paid people in the country, really. And I think that we should make credit life insurance mandatory if the loan, the principal debt does not exceed 50,000, so up to 50,000, and then that's it. Above that, those people are getting those loans. I don't know how you get a loan above that for 50,000, 100,000 rand if you're only earning 7,500 rand a month. Well, yes.
Good heavens. Certainly don't want to legislate something illegal. So you've got a point there. But let us just work out how much would you be paying, more or less? What would it look like? Anyone from DTI? National regulator? Credit regulator? If you took out insurance and you... In fact, I understand, is it your net or your gross that's 7.5? Gross. Insurance you'd go out and pay, you know, at the moment as you're sitting there. People are paying insurance, many of them. And the problem is, they go and they take out insurance, that's exactly one of the problems we had. And when you are retrenched and you need to use that insurance, you don't get reminded that you've got it. And then by the time you remember, it's too late. Yes.
On a 50,000 rand loan, that will be 225 rand per month.
225 rand a month, eh?
Sorry, Jay, keeping in mind that is the full 50,000 now, because remember when we were talking about 50,000, we were having many agreements in mind. So if it would be a 10,000, it will be a fifth of that, and
what I'm looking at, some people who for their car insurance who are paying something like 150, 200, are saying, oh gosh, you know, is there anything cheaper than this? And they're earning way above 7,500. I've heard that in this very parliament. Yes, Honourable Macpherson. Sorry, you didn't have your hand up. No.
Are we sure that it's 225 rand per month?
You can get car insurance for lower.
I mean, what is the maximum rate per? Is it per thousand? Sorry.
450.
Per thousand.
For the 50,000, you pay 450 per month. Because you're looking at the principal debt, which is 50,000. So for each thousand in that 50,000.
Stephen Mindler, I don't know who you're talking to. Please, into the mic.
Sorry, Chair. So I was just trying to explain the financial implication. For the principal debt of 50,000, you pay 450 for each thousand in that principal debt. That's why it amounts to 225, sorry. I don't know if you understand my example.
Oh, I see. That's the
for 1,000 rand you pay 450
as the maximum.
As the maximum, and right. that credit life insurance premium will be based on each and every 1,000 of the 50,000 per month. Yes.
Right. Do we want to consider staggering it a bit, depending on what it is? You see, I don't know if you're already getting into debt on that. It would have been so much better if you would look at something like R100 a month. Yes, Advocate van der Merwe.
Just another thought. The 450 is something that is prescribed. So perhaps we can provide that the minister must prescribe a cap for this compulsory credit life insurance. That is perhaps, and then that can be brought down. I understand that on mortgages it's R2.50. The problem is it is the maximum. So your credit provider can charge R1, but with all due respect, would they charge R1? That we don't know. And you can't say that it's illegal if they charged R4.50 because that was is allowed. But so we can perhaps cap it at the 50,000 and then say use the same wording in respect of the prescribe to cap this one as well at then a low, and then the minister can just cap it low.
Do we want to consider that? Yes, Honourable William?
Chairperson, if there is credit life insurance available on the bonds for cheaper, for R2.50, then why can't we do that? It's not like it doesn't exist. We've created something. It's impossible to do a credit life insurance for that cheap. But they're already doing it for bonds. So it is there. So, I mean, I think we should definitely look at that. I think we should say that that's what we want. We want the cheapest credit life insurance that's available out of all of it, and that's the one we're going to use. So we're not going to say R1.50. You know, as government, we're going to 50 cents per thousand. You know, we can't force the credit, the insurers to do that, but we can use something that already exists. Thank you.
Yes, no, I think point taken, but we've got two hands that flew up.
Yeah,
Honourable Jester Hazen, followed by the Honourable MacPherson.
Madam Chair, yes, I have to agree with the Honourable Williams. It just seems extreme. You know, on R100,000, that will be 450, 5-year period, it'll be R27,000. R27,000 on a 5-year period. But that's without interest, just the insurance will be R27,000.
Does everyone want to change jobs? Yes, Honourable MacPherson.
I think before we start putting numbers down, it might be helpful to have a discussion with the industry. I mean, I can understand why you would probably have a cheaper rate on your mortgage, because you have a realizable asset that can be disposed of. So when you're talking about unsecured credit, there's obviously a risk because there is no asset attached to that agreement. So there has to be a premium on risk. So I think before we start, buttoning this thing down, it might be helpful to have a discussion with the industry.
It'd be a good idea to have that once this bill's published. Quite a good idea. So when it's been published, they've all seen it. They've already heard what we've had to say. Let them see it and comment. We'll get a broad range of comments. I'm just going, you can do that as a follow-up, Honourable MacPherson. Let me take the Honourable Montash.
Chair, now, I just want to ask, when are we ready to go for public hearings?
We will go to hearings after the bill has been published. They're going to get the benefit of 6 weeks, as it were. Then it would allow members here, the staff, to collate everything, as it were, and then we'll come back and look at it. So we're looking at when, Mr. Hermans?
Public hearing is probably scheduled for January 2018 on the bill, if everything works in terms of what we schedule.
On the current track, on the current. Honourable MacPherson, follow up. Honourable Biani, fresh.
Thanks, Chair. I disagree with your comment that we can just sort of resolve this in the public hearings, because in order to publish a bill, I think we need to know what those rates are. We can't just thumbsuck a number and then say, oh, well, we'll deal with it when the public hearings take place. I mean, so I think it would be helpful to have those, you know, those costs now, so that can shape the bill to go for public hearings.
I think that information is already available in the same way the information that we got concerning 2000 and the inflation, etc. It is available. We have recourse to National Treasury, the National Credit Regulator. We've got that information available. So we will, obviously, this will be factored in as the bill is crafted forward. Yes, Honourable Buyani?
Thanks, Chair. I think I'm partly covered in terms of that, because really, if there's any comment that should be made, it should be a public participation in the process and also the consultation by the ministers and so forth. Thanks, Chair.
Right. So that is something one would expect. Oh, sorry, Honourable Williams, was that hand up?
Sorry, no, I came in late, Chairperson, but I did propose that not exceeding 50,000 Rand was our maximum, and I didn't know whether or not we're still talking about the 100,000 or are we going for the 50,000, and we can just say 50,000, it's on, yeah.
No, I think the majority of the members agreed on the 50. Yes, I mean, as one said, earning 7,500, is it not reckless to try and lend me 100,000? Thank you. Right. Sorry, Ms. Gibson?
Just a point of clarity. Most of the discussion that we've been having related to the bill in general relates to unsecured loans. But in some of the examples, we've now been talking about cars, which are obviously not unsecured loans. So I'm just wanting a point of clarity. Are we, in terms of what's being proposed here, does this still only relate to unsecured, or are we now talking about secured and unsecured?
Just a moment, Ms. Gibson, all right? Nothing like throwing this in at 11, yeah. Let me just check on something here. Point is this, my understanding, I'm looking here on page 31, all right, when this came up, I think is it at the bottom here, page 31, where the term of a credit, B1A, of a credit agreement exceeds 6 months, and the principal debt, we know now it's 50. The affected credit provider and consumer must enter into that in term of that. Now, the thing is, you earn 7,500. It could still, you know, you enter into the credit agreement. It means that it is, in fact, secured in a manner of that physical object, for example. There's certain things that one can purchase that cost 20,000 and still retain it. It isn't necessarily unsecured as I understood it, but let's check with the chairperson of the subcommittee.
Well, I don't know if that qualifies me to answer that question, but what I'm thinking here is this particular clause talks to all credit that must be have credit life insurance. So we're saying to all of South Africa, if you go in and get debt, you know, to 7,500, and you, because you might not be in a, you might be earning 7,500 rand a month, but you might not want debt relief. You have got a good credit rating, you've been paying off your debt. Now you've made another debt of 50,000 Rand, regardless of what that is, whether it's secured debt or unsecured debt, you still need to have credit life insurance. That's what this clause is saying. Now, it's not related to the individual that's applying for debt relief, not necessarily related, because you can be an individual earning 7,500 Rand a month, applying for 50,000 Rand credit, and that individual must have, but I'm also not sure whether or not we're including everybody who applies for 50,000 rand credit. So maybe that is. Maybe it shouldn't. Maybe it's for everybody in South Africa. If you apply up to 50,000 rand credit, you've got to have credit life insurance.
Is that what we want to pay? I think that's the question. Is that what we want? Has everyone seriously considered this? No. Do you know why I'm saying it? People do have other forms of insurance as well. I mean, Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Jay. Just to confirm three things. First off, yes, currently this clause applies to everyone regardless of your income. Secondly, it applies to secured and unsecured credit agreements. And thirdly, the Act does provide that if the consumer has other insurance, that can be given to the credit provider instead of this. So you can take out other insurance. That is possible. So it's not that if you have a different product already, you can do that. So then that will negate this. But currently, yeah, the question would also be, should it be secured and unsecured, and should it be for everyone?
Gibson, does that answer your question, or do you have a further clarification on what we want?
It does, thank you. I think the issue around when you have to have credit insurance is obviously connected to when you qualify for debt relief. And so I suppose from our side, we would need to be thinking very carefully about, it's one thing to be talking about extinguishing debt for an unsecured loan. It's another thing to be talking about extinguishing debt for a secured loan. Because the nature of the lending market is different. In other words, it's risk-rated and calculated based on the fact that if something goes wrong, you can get back the asset. Now we're saying, no, you actually can't get back the asset. So I think from our side, it's also just something I'm just flagging that we would like to take greater reflection on.
Look, I think there is a little misunderstanding here. Allow me to get the Advocate van der Merwe just to explain what it is we're getting at, because this is a very important point.
Thank you, Chair. I think the confusion maybe comes in that this bill between draft 3 and draft 4 has actually expanded a bit. So we are also now looking at measures to address reckless lending, the mandatory credit life insurance. So mandatory credit life insurance is not linked in the bill to the debt intervention measure. It's two separate issues. So the debt intervention measure is only on unsecured debt.
Thank you.
What I want to say is, this measure, this 1A, is there to prevent or to create circumstances in the future that we don't have to pass another debt relief measure, because everybody will be covered to the 50,000 rand with credit life insurance. That's the theory of it.
Isn't that what you were also hoping for, Honourable MacPherson? Yes. So there we are. Now, we can move. Advocate van der Merwe, we needed you so much at that point. Right. Carry on.
Okay. Chair, the last is about the last 3 points, and I think we can combine them because the answer would be the same thing, is about the penalties for offences. We are going to start
35.
Yes, it starts on page 35, but actually I would like maybe to go to the penalties itself. Let's focus on the penalties. I will do the backtracking and make the changes going backwards. So if we go to page 39, starting with, it will be clause 24, substitution of section 161. So first I would just like to explain to members something from the Criminal Prosecution Act. I explained it yesterday, but it's sometimes just nicer to see it actually. So I've printed this out, so members should have it, but I want to go to, it is section 276 of the Criminal Procedure Act and subsection 3. Now, what it says in subsection 3 is that regardless of what any other law says, so in fact if we say here that if you commit an offence, you are liable to a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 10 years.
Has everyone got the single page? Right.
So if our bill says that you are liable to a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 10 years, regardless of the fact that it says that, then we come back to subsection 3. It still does not stop the court. So the fact that it says it does not stop the court from imposing imprisonment together with correctional supervision or from imposing the punishment in subsection 1H or I in respect of that offence. Now, H or I is correctional in one, is correctional supervision or imprisonment from which the person may be placed under correctional supervision. So if we keep that in mind and we then look at one, what are the possible sentences that may be passed if your bill says nothing, if your act is quiet? Imprisonment, periodical imprisonment, declaration as a habitual criminal, committal to an institution, a fine, correctional supervision, or imprisonment from which you may be placed under correctional supervision. So, if our bill says a fine or 10-year suspension, and we keep subsection 3 in mind, what would be the sentence that a court can impose? A court can impose the sentence in 1B, which is imprisonment, because our bill will say up to a maximum of 10 years. C, periodical imprisonment will not be applicable. Periodical imprisonment is where you are sentenced to a month now, then you go out and you come back after a month for another month or something like that. It's very, very seldom applied. D, declaration as a habitual criminal. That is a separate application that is made by the state for a person who has more than once or more than two or three times committed a similar crime. So it will not be affected by our bill, and the court will be able to make that sentence, impose that sentence in any event, because it will be based on another application. Committal to any institution established by law, that is something that the court will still be able to make in any event, because if the person appears to not be aware currently or during the commission of the crime of what they are doing, then there is a process in the Criminal Procedure Act where the person is referred for observation. Observation comes back and says, no, this person did not know what they were doing at the time, or they don't know what they're doing now. And then the person is referred to an institution to be held there, and no sentence is imposed anyway. So it doesn't affect that one. A fine, our law provides for that. H and I, subsection 3 says that can be imposed. So the way our bill reads does not exclude section 276 at all. So all of these normal punishments are still available to the court. So if we work from that, yes. So in other words, it's simply that it is a way of wording things to say to a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 10 years. So the big question is whether we are happy with this kind of time period, if we feel it should not be as harsh, if it should be less, because remember this is the maximum. So we need to look at the worst case scenario, the worst person that committed this offence. Because if a person is if the person committed less of an offence, if I can call it that, there's maybe mitigating circumstances and so on, the court will just impose a fine and it could be small. The first one that we can look at is and then I'm going to go a little bit back, but I'll put it up on the screen because perhaps members can retain on the page that you are, and I'll put up on the screen the offence that we're dealing with. Mr. Williams was concerned about the first one where we say up to a maximum of 10 years for a person who has submitted false information or has intended to mislead the National Credit Regulator or the tribunal, because what if the person made a mistake? But if we look at how this is worded, if you submit false information, in other words, in fact, if necessary, I can add intentionally submit false information. Yeah, and the other one is intended to mislead. So the So you submit the false information, and you word your things in such a way with the intention to mislead. So if you made a mistake, that's not intended to mislead. You didn't understand the form, you know, so then you will be found not guilty. So I think that we are covered there. It won't affect, especially if you think about it, someone might be applying on an English form and their home language is a different language. It won't affect that kind of person because that would be, but I don't even, you know, it was an English form. Yeah. So that would be that. Then the second one is also deliberately alters financial circumstances in order to qualify. So there's also, it's a deliberate changing of the circumstances in order to qualify. So it's, in fact, this will be a very easy one to prove because you will see that there was a change in circumstances and suddenly the person's income is 7,500 rand and they have no realizable assets. And then they will be guilty of an offense. So the question then is, if we look again at the offenses side, and I'll maybe split my screen, I'll do that next, is I'm saying that a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 10 years. So a person who really he looks for these white-collar opportunities and he took advantage of this measure, what would we like that person to get? In other words, he might have already done this in the past. Should we bring it down to 5 years, which I think is still a serious offence, a serious penalty, I mean, or is 10 years sufficient? So that's maybe maybe we can stop with that one first and just...
This was came up yesterday again, Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, I think that when we insert some of those words, like a willful intent to... change the information, when it becomes that, as that makes a big difference to alleviate anybody that has, in fact, erred in that. But I think that it's the punishment is not exceeding 10 years. In other words, then they could be given less than 10 years, and it's the discretion of, obviously, the person that's prosecuting them or judging them. So I think we should leave it as it is. I was just concerned about people that may have made a mistake, the examples that were given, an error because of you didn't understand the form, that sort of thing. But if somebody is willfully, changing things in order to commit fraud, on this process, then definitely we should keep this 10 years. So I propose that we keep the 10 years and then adjust those things, the other clauses, as was recommended by the advocate. Thank you.
Just check with you, Advocate Vandermeer, because it was the first time I'd ever come across periodical imprisonment. I suppose you could go to prison during the holidays or something. But, I never came across that term. Now I'm wondering... if under the 10 years, does this periodical imprisonment apply across the board? In other words, it can be, if you're sentenced to a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and then periodically go to jail when you're sort of exhausted or something.
That is actually a penalty, even though I have practiced for a number of years, that I've never come across, and discussing with my colleagues never come across. The purpose of that is, in fact, during holidays. So, in other words, it would be a person who is perhaps a sole breadwinner in a family, and then it was not a serious offence, it was maybe shoplifting, but it was his third offence of shoplifting. So the court might say, look, I do understand your circumstances, I do understand that you work, but you will then, for the next 3 years, serve a month in prison every year, and you must report to this prison on this date and this date and this date. So it will be something like that. I don't think it's the kind of thing that will be applicable with our thing. If it really becomes necessary, it is still a possible, it's still there. It is a possible order that the court may make. But like I say, I've never come across it. I think it is very difficult for a court to actually... for the prisons, rather, to actually monitor, because your risk of the person disappearing between year one and year two increases, and so your monitoring becomes very, very difficult.
Now, I've just asked because I've never heard of that. But as you say, you yourself have not practically come across it in your practicing life as an attorney or advocate, rather. All right, I think this was discussed yesterday as well. I think we have exhausted it. All right, looking around, everyone seems happy enough. Can we move on then, Advocate van der Merwe?
Thank you, Chair. The last one then would be in relation to a person who has participated in unlawful credit marketing practice, who does not comply with the Act. I've now listed them in 157B, so I'll scroll through them slowly there at the top. Does not comply with limitations in respect of a private dwelling or a person's place of employment. So you're unlawfully entering in the sense of that you should not be selling there. Entering into reckless credit agreement, entering into an unlawful credit agreement, or put in an unlawful provision, or you offer or demand that a person purchases insurance that is unreasonable at an unreasonable cost, or to cover a risk that reasonably cannot arise, for instance, retrenchment for a person who's on pension, commits an offence. So for these persons, and then perhaps it should be extended to a person who operates without registration, it is the same proposal, that is a fine not exceeding 10 years, or both fine and imprisonment, and then, or if the person is not a natural person, so I'm now at reading from section 161, A capital B. In the case of contravention, page 39. So again, I'm proposing 10 years or to both a fine. And then where the person is not a natural person, so in other words, if it is a firm, a company, then a fine not exceeding 10% of its annual turnover. I did not bring the million in here. I can bring that in here. But I thought that is maybe the 10% of annual turnover should be quite appropriate there. So, yeah, is that appropriate?
Williams?
Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to this, I don't think we should put in R1 million, because if you're a big institution, it's a very little amount of money. So I think we should keep the 10% of annual turnover as a penalty for that if you're a company and you breach this. Because we mustn't only in this bill try to create borrowers, responsible borrowing, but it's responsible lending as well. And we must deter illegal and dodgy practices from people. And I think 10% of their annual turnover is quite a deterrent. Thank you.
I was just trying to think of what, I know the Competition Commission has also got certain penalties, etc. I'm not sure if anyone sitting here is that familiar with some of those penalties and the percentages, etc., that would be charged. Of course, then there's also SARS, the Revenue Office itself, which has a penalty, various penalties, plus you pay the existing tax. That. Yes, Honourable van der Merwe, well, let's just hear what the regulator is saying and then if you'll come back.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. We would like to suggest that the way the penalties are worded in the Act must remain, because 10% turnover can be 10 rands. And if we say the greater of 10% or 1 million, then at least, we know that, the fine can be hefty. So the minimum has to be determined.
Now, that provokes another question on my part, but thank you, Honourable Williams.
Chippers, my question would be, how could 10% be 10 rand if they're annual, they're a company. They have to defend, they have to, I mean, it's a very small company that's, first of all, broken all of these rules. So they must have something. But I do understand the point that's been made. So perhaps we should say that the minimum is, just as the National Credit Regulators did say, that it's R1 million or 10% of the annual turnover, however they said it. But I do agree that we should have a minimum of R1 million.
Yes, So on the other hand, I mean, you could have these multi-billion, much larger companies, and then is it fair for the smaller company to be charged what you're suggesting, and then the larger company, multi-million, to be charged merely 10%? I don't know. We come into a lot of other things then. I like the idea of, you know, trying to look at whatever is the greater. So you say 10%, right, 10% across the board, as it were. However, or a million, isn't that it? Minimum. So you'd have to pay whatever is the larger, the greater. Don't we go along with that one? Huh? I heard you mention that yesterday, Advocate van der Merwe.
Yes, Chair. In fact, that is how the Act reads. So I just wanted to point out that the amounts that we use here, we got from looking at the Credit Act, the BEE, Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act, as well as Competition Commission, the Competition Act. So all three of those have this this calculation. So yes, I can add the million, and it will then simply read that, and it's in any event not exceeding. So if it is a smaller company, it's not to say that it must be a million. For a smaller company, the court may look at what was the annual turnover, but then if it is maybe a bad year and they only made R1,000, then you know, then it can be higher. The way of calculating the annual turnover is the previous year's turnover. So maybe they've just started now and the previous year's turnover was zero. So that's perhaps where the million then is a good thing to include. So I'll just include that.
Well, just before we just go smartly ahead, what is the Competition Commission saying? Does it include the million or does it say 10%?
It includes the million.
It includes four. You know, they've had, it's one of our more recent acts, as it were, more up-to-date and so on. So do we agree with that second version, 10% or a million, whichever is the greater? We agree with that. Fine. Thank you. Let's move on. I thought that was the last, actually.
That is the last, Chair.
Right.
The remaining question just is, do I also include a person who is not registered and operates without registration?
You know that one.
And make it part of this type of penalty.
I don't know. Not even give them that person a fine. Maybe let them sit inside somewhere. But, you see, I mean, they should all be registered. Do we include these folks here? I mean, you know, Honourable William?
Chairperson, to include people that aren't registered, I don't know what that means, because, you know, because they're illegal, they're not registered, so how would you find them? But you see, if you've been given a loan from an unregistered, automatically they've broken the law, haven't they? And what makes them illegal currently? That's the question.
And then would you have to pay such an illegal person?
Chair, the current position, but if I'm wrong, the regulator and DDI can assist me. Currently, it is just that it's an unlawful agreement. It's not an offence. So we've made it an offence now. So you just can't enforce it. So we've made it an offence. So I've included it there. But currently, I haven't provided for a fine. So the fine for that, then, currently, according to the Act, would be 12 months. And I just think that that's not a fair number of years for someone who, because like I explained yesterday, I mean, a big concern is people who operate as credit providers without being registered. So I just want to see where I've done it. Offences related to registration. So 157C, any person who gives himself out as a credit provider or as a credit provider of development credit, a credit bureau, a debt counsellor, a payment distribution agent, alternative dispute resolution agent without having been registered, now will commit an offence. So my proposal is that for them, we should also do the 10 years exactly the same.
We agree on that, members. We want people to be registered, surely. Yes, Honourable William.
Chairperson, I think that because it's not an offence currently, we should definitely make it an offence. So we should include them. Now, how are we going to get them is more complicated, but that doesn't matter. Once we've got them, they're going to pay. And I don't think they should also have up to 10 years or R1 million, exactly the same as everybody else. So they should be included, even though they're unregistered, and they might get other fines from elsewhere. Yeah.
Yes, I think we must. But, you know, I really do think that before what we should do in the public hearings and when this goes out, is to make sure we're encouraging those who are not yet registered to go out there and get registered before this becomes law. Go out there, get registered. So that it should be also a proactive approach to the matter. I don't know if our jails are going to be big enough. So let's just come back. You know, they're already bursting at the seams. And on a serious note, I mean, how many of these don't you know? I work in an informal settlement area. They're around every little block. Anyway, let's have a look at members. Can we please, I'm appealing to you to just have one last look back at the area we could not fully agree on, where we agreed on principle and get a proposal, a couple of proposals. Do you remember that, Honourable MacPherson? So, if we definitely can't agree, we'll take it to our caucuses. But remember, the caucuses take place tomorrow. It would have been pretty useful for us to hear what others are saying to take to our respective caucuses. Can we try that? Do you want to make a start there, Honourable MacPherson? I mean, there were quite a few things then, was it, that we didn't agree with. Do go ahead.
Chair, okay, to find them all might not be that quick. I think I'm just going to quickly speak. I'll go to this document, the report of the subcommittee. That might be the easiest way. There were a couple of things that we flagged that we needed to look at. The one was, we agreed on that. The one was about the training issue and how to word the time frame, how to change the for a person not to be able to apply for credit again. So how to word that. So to think about that, I will also draft something there to make proposals. The other thing was about the education. The third thing was... the fact of prescribing the minister to prescribe.
Remember the minister's prescription, the prescribing area, the clauses there, right?
And I think those are the big flags. So
right. So the empowerment training or whatever. How do we settle on a period for this? How do we link it? And how is it provided? Issues around that, and then finally giving the bill which would enable the minister to prescribe. All right? Those are the two. Do you want to come out now and just put a final kind of position for various caucuses to consider? And then, of course, we bring it back. But it's useful when everyone's heard other caucuses so that they themselves can take it to their caucus and say, this party is saying X, what do we think? Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you. I think if there is a deletion of 2C, I think that makes it probably more manageable. So it focuses... if there is a deletion of 2C, that's what the ministerial powers... that makes it more manageable, and that it then only focuses on natural disasters. Although I'm still concerned on the job loss part, because I do take Ms. Gibson's point that it's actually an insured risk and not sort of a natural risk. With respect to training, I do like the Honourable Williams' idea about, you know, being able to shorten the exclusion, you know, if you do you know, some form of an accredited course, which I'm sure the NCR could you know, accredit. But I think, I mean, I just don't believe that it can be possible to go through debt relief and not have some form of rehabilitation through some sort of educational program, because, I mean, it's completely defeating, you know, what we want to do, which is also change behavior. I mean, that has to be surely an objective. So unless we can see that, I think it's also quite difficult to, you know, to understand, you know, what we want to achieve. So I think that Honourable Williams' idea is good, and then, but I think that there needs to be some development over what that education program is going to be.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. Right, Honourable. I mean, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, with regard to 2C, I don't think we can pronounce now as the ANC whether or not we'll remove that. So that's a study group position. And also, with regard to the training, we absolutely agree that there should be some mechanism for empowering the consumer on exactly what debt means, that sort of thing, to stop this from happening in the future. But we do have to take this back to study groups. We can't propose today as the ANC. Thank you.
Does the IFP want to just share their thoughts on those two matters with us again, Mr. Honourable Esterhazen?
Madam Chair, thank you. My concern is just that you know, in the current financial climate that we live in, consumers are driven to even more desperate measures, and this is what's blowing this all out of proportion. They will go to from one debt financial source to another, and to loan shark for even more expensive money. And that is what we're trying to prevent.
Right, I think, you know, the EFF is not with us, but I will communicate this to the Honourable Tlangwini during the course of the meeting. She heard about an unexpected, very close bereavement in her family, so I had to leave quite urgently. So I will communicate this to her for her party to look at and get a response from them. Of course, we also have the Honourable Anton Elberts in this regard, and he's also, you know, unfortunately at the disadvantage of the same problem of a personal bereavement. We will communicate this to him as well. Because what I would like this bill to be taken to your caucuses, this crafted bill so far. There are one or two areas we may still engage on, and particularly the two that are on the table right now. And then it is my, you know, I had rather hoped to refrain from the Thursday night on the issue, and I think we can still do that, and come back then on Friday as already planned. Mr. Hermans is asking me, does it have to be at 8? Looking at some of the problems on the road, can we make it 8:30? I'm thinking of the villagers. The buses there seem to have a real problem, and, you know, the bus only seems to get here at 8:15 or so. So can we move that to 8:30? Is that okay with on Friday? So 8:30 until 3:30. We have to get through the cane growers. We have no choice. And I said to Mr. Hermans, if necessary, we should have made it 1600, because that's a very serious meeting. The reason I say that is we've got the long one on the debt. We have to get this off the table. We have to finish that, and it may well be until 11, the debt. Then we'll start briefly with a briefing there, and then the cane growers can come in. So those of you who are keen on booking flights, we may continue until 1600 on Friday. And I don't intend taking the committee meeting to the airport. I will if I have to. Right. We just take the flag along in Mr. Herman's and we'll have a committee meeting. Now, on a more serious
But can we have it in the slow lounge, not the SAA lounge?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. The food there is
much more enjoyable. SAA, you don't know if it's ever going to leave.
Yeah. But no, we could even arrange that. But on the meetings next week, you asked us in particular about when we're going to be hoping to take this bill to the media, that we had scheduled for the 14th. Tuesday the 14th, media briefing committee bill. All right? And how's that getting on?
It's depending on how the committee is. That other option is to continue the events that you have as well.
Right. All right. Is there anything else that we need? The venue for Friday will be Good Hope Chamber. Why up there? On Friday. Well, look, I'm sorry, it's the Good Hope Chamber, but I gather now they've finished the repairs, have they?
Yeah.
Right, so we won't have all the hammering. All right, members, Good Hope Chamber on Friday, 8:30. Please, can everyone try and be there, because this is the committee bill. Let's make it our bill. Please, members. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.